Disc 22.
Mr. Bulstrode had lowered his eyes from Lydgate's face to the buttons of his coat as he again paused.
"No doubt that is a good device as to ways and means," said Lydgate, with an edge of irony in his tone. "But I can't be expected to rejoice in it at once, since one of the first results will be that the other medical men will upset or interrupt my methods, if it were only because they are mine."
"I myself, as you know, Mr. Lydgate, highly value the opportunity of new and independent procedure which you have diligently employed. The original plan, I confess, was one which I had much at heart, under submission to the divine will. But since providential indications demand a renunciation from me, I renounce."
Bulstrode showed a rather exasperating ability in this conversation. The broken metaphor and bad logic of motive which had stirred his hearer's contempt were quite consistent with a mode of putting the facts which made it difficult for Lydgate to vent his own indignation and disappointment. After some rapid reflection, he only asked,
"What did Mrs. Casaubon say?"
"That was the further statement which I wished to make to you," said Bulstrode, who had thoroughly prepared his ministerial explanation. "She is, you are aware, a woman of most munificent disposition, and happily in possession, not, I presume, of great wealth, but of funds which she can well spare. She has informed me that though she had destined the chief part of those funds to another purpose, she is willing to consider whether she cannot fully take my place in relation to the hospital. But she wishes for ample time to mature her thoughts on the subject, and I have told her that there is no need for haste, that, in fact, my own plans are not yet absolute."
Lydgate was ready to say, "If Mrs. Casaubon would take your place, there would be gain instead of loss."
But there was still a weight on his mind which arrested this cheerful candour. He replied,
"I suppose then that I may enter into the subject with Mrs. Casaubon."
"Precisely. That is what she expressly desires. Her decision, she says, will much depend on what you can tell her. But not at present. She is, I believe, just setting out on a journey."
"I have her letter here," said Mr. Bulstrode, drawing it out and reading from it. "I am immediately otherwise engaged," she says. "I am going into Yorkshire with Sir James and Lady Chetham, and the conclusions I come to about some land which I am to see there may affect my power of contributing to the hospital. Thus, Mr. Lydgate, there is no haste necessary in this matter, but I wish to apprise you beforehand of what may possibly occur."
Mr. Bulstrode returned the letter to his side pocket and changed his attitude as if his business were closed. Lydgate, whose renewed hope about the hospital only made him more conscious of the facts which poisoned his hope, felt that his effort after help, if made at all, must be made now and vigorously.
"I am much obliged to you for giving me full notice," he said, with a firm intention in his tone, yet with an interruptedness in his delivery which showed that he spoke unwillingly. "The highest object to me is my profession, and I had identified the hospital with the best use I can at present make of my profession. But the best use is not always the same with monetary success. Everything which has made the hospital unpopular has helped with other causes, I think they are all connected with my professional zeal, to make me unpopular as a practitioner. I get chiefly patients who can't pay me. I should like them best if I had nobody to pay on my own side."
Lydgate waited a little, but Bulstrode only bowed, looking at him fixedly. And he went on with the same interrupted enunciation, as if he were biting an objectionable leek.
"I have slipped into money difficulties which I can see no way out of, unless someone who trusts me and my future will advance me a sum without other security. I had very little fortune left when I came here. I have no prospects of money from my own family. My expenses in consequence of my marriage have been very much greater than I had expected. The result at this moment is that it would take £1,000 to clear me. I mean, to free me from the risk of having all my goods sold in security of my largest debt, as well as to pay other debts, and leave anything to keep us a little beforehand with our small income. I find that it is out of the question that my wife's father should make such an advance. That is why I mention my position to the only other man who may be held to have some personal connection with my prosperity or ruin. Lydgate hated to hear himself, but he had spoken now, and had spoken with unmistakable directness. Mr. Bulstrode replied without haste, but also without hesitation.
"I am grieved, though I confess not surprised, by this information, Mr. Lydgate. For my own part, I regretted your alliance with my brother-in-law's family, which has always been of prodigal habits, and which has already been much indebted to me for sustainment in its present position. My advice to you, Mr. Lydgate, would be that instead of involving yourself in further obligations and continuing a doubtful struggle, you should simply become a bankrupt."
"That would not improve my prospect," said Lydgate, rising and speaking bitterly, "even if it were a more agreeable thing in itself."
"It is always a trial," said Mr. Bulstrode. "But trial, my dear sir, is our portion here, and is a needed corrective. I recommend you to weigh the advice I have given."
"Thank you," said Lydgate, not quite knowing what he said. "I have occupied you too long. Good day."
Chapter 68. That change of plan and shifting of interest, which Bulstrode stated or betrayed in his conversation with Lydgate, had been determined in him by some severe experience which he had gone through since the epoch of Mr. Larcher's sale, when Raffles had recognised Will Ladislaw, and when the banker had in vain attempted an act of restitution which might move divine providence to arrest painful consequences. His certainty that Raffles, unless he were dead, would return to Middlemarch before long, had been justified. On Christmas Eve he had reappeared at the Shrubs. Bulstrode was at home to receive him and hinder his communication with the rest of the family, but he could not altogether hinder the circumstances of the visit from compromising himself and alarming his wife. Raffles proved more unmanageable than he had shown himself to be in his former appearances. His chronic state of mental restlessness, the growing effect of habitual intemperance, quickly shaking off every impression from what was said to him. He insisted on staying in the house, and Bulstrode, weighing two sets of evils, felt that this was at least not a worse alternative than his going into the town. He kept him in his own room for the evening, and saw him to bed, Raffles all the while amusing himself with the annoyance he was causing this decent and highly prosperous fellow sinner, an amusement which he facetiously expressed as sympathy with his friend's pleasure in entertaining a man who had been serviceable to him and who had not had all his earnings. There was a cunning calculation under this noisy joking, a cool resolve to extract something the handsomer from Bulstrode as payment for release from this new application of torture. But his cunning had a little overcast its mark. Bulstrode was indeed more tortured than the coarse fibre of Raffles could enable him to imagine. He had told his wife that he was simply taking care of this wretched creature, the victim of vice, who might otherwise injure himself. He implied, without the direct form of falsehood, that there was a family tie which bound him to this care, and that there were signs of mental alienation in Raffles which urged caution. He would himself drive the unfortunate being away the next morning. In these hints, he felt that he was supplying Mrs. Bulstrode with precautionary information for his daughters and servants, and accounting for his allowing no one but himself to enter the room even with food and drink. But he sat in an agony of fear, lest Raffles should be overheard in his loud and plain references to past facts, lest Mrs. Bulstrode should be even tempted to listen at the door. How could he hinder her? How betray his terror by opening the door to detect her? She was a woman of honest, direct habits, and little likely to take so low a course in order to arrive at painful knowledge, but fear was stronger than the calculation of probabilities. In this way, Raffles had pushed the torture too far, and produced an effect which had not been in his plan. By showing himself hopelessly unmanageable, he had made Bulstrode feel that a strong defiance was the only resource left. After taking Raffles to bed that night, the banker ordered his closed carriage to be ready at 7:30 the next morning. At 6 o'clock, he had already been long dressed, and had spent some of his wretchedness in prayer, pleading his motives for averting the worst evil, if in anything he had used falsity and spoken what was not true before God. For Bulstrode shrank from a direct lie with an intensity disproportionate to the number of his more indirect misdeeds. But many of these misdeeds were like the subtle muscular movements which are not taken account of in the consciousness, though they bring about the end that we fix our mind on and desire. And it is only what we are vividly conscious of that we can vividly imagine to be seen by omniscience. Bulstrode carried his candle to the bedside of Raffles, who was apparently in a painful dream. He stood silent, hoping that the presence of the light would serve to waken the sleeper gradually and gently, for he feared some noise as the consequence of a too sudden awakening. He had watched for a couple of minutes or more the shudderings and pantings which seemed likely to end in waking, when Raffles, with a long, half-stifled moan, started up and stared round him in terror, trembling and gasping. But he made no further noise, and Bulstrode, setting down the candle, awaited his recovery. It was 1/4 hour later before Bulstrode, with a cold peremptoriness of manner which he had not before shown, said, "I came to call you thus early, Mr. Raffles, because I have ordered the carriage to be ready at 7:30, and intend myself to conduct you as far as Ilsley, where you can either take the railway or await a coach." Raffles was about to speak, but Bulstrode anticipated him imperiously with the words, "Be silent, sir, and hear what I have to say. I shall supply you with money now, and I will furnish you with a reasonable sum from time to time on your application to me by letter. But if you choose to present yourself here again, if you return to Middlemarch, if you use your tongue in a manner injurious to me, you will have to live on such fruits as your malice can bring you without help from me. Nobody will pay you well for blasting my name. I know the worst you can do against me, and I shall brave it if you dare to thrust yourself upon me again. Get up, sir, and do as I order you without noise, or I will send for a policeman to take you off my premises, and you may carry your stories into every pothouse in the town, but you shall have no sixpence from me to pay your expenses there." Bulstrode had rarely in his life spoken with such nervous energy. He had been deliberating on this speech and its probable effects through a large part of the night, and though he did not trust to its ultimately saving him from any return of Raffles, he had concluded that it was the best throw he could make. It succeeded in enforcing submission from the jaded man this morning. His empoisoned system at this moment quailed before Bulstrode's cold, resolute bearing, and he was taken off quietly in the carriage before the family breakfast time. The servants imagined him to be a poor relation, and were not surprised that a strict man like their master, who held his head high in the world, should be ashamed of such a cousin and want to get rid of him. The banker's drive of 10 miles with his hated companion was a dreary beginning of the Christmas day, but at the end of the drive Raffles had recovered his spirits and parted in a contentment for which there was the good reason that the banker had given him £100. Various motives urged Bulstrode to this open-handedness, but he did not himself inquire closely into all of them. As he had stood watching Raffles in his uneasy sleep, it had certainly entered his mind that the man had been much shattered since the first gift of £200. He had taken care to repeat the incisive statement of his resolve not to be played on any more, and had tried to penetrate Raffles with the fact that he had shown the risks of bribing him to be quite equal to the risks of defying him. But when, freed from his repulsive presence, Bulstrode returned to his quiet home, he brought with him no confidence that he had secured more than a respite. It was as if he had had a loathsome dream, and could not shake off its images with their hateful kindred of sensations, as if on all the pleasant surroundings of his life a dangerous reptile had left his slimy traces. Who can know how much of his most inward life is made up of the thoughts he believes other men to have about him, until that fabric of opinion is threatened with ruin?
Bulstrode was only the more conscious that there was a deposit of uneasy presentiment in his wife's mind, because she carefully avoided any allusion to it. He had been used every day to taste the flavour of supremacy and the tribute of complete deference, and the certainty that he was watched or measured with a hidden suspicion of his having some discreditable secret made his voice totter when he was speaking to edification. Foreseeing to men of Bulstrode's anxious temperament is often worse than seeing, and his imagination continually heightened the anguish of an imminent disgrace. Yes, imminent, for if his defiance of Raffles did not keep the man away, and though he prayed for this result he hardly hoped for it, the disgrace was certain. In vain he said to himself that, if permitted, it would be a divine visitation, a chastisement, a preparation. He recoiled from the imagined burning, and he judged that it must be more for the divine glory that he should escape dishonour. That recoil had at last urged him to make preparations for quitting Middlemarch. If evil truth must be reported of him, he would then be at a less scorching distance from the contempt of his old neighbours, and in a new scene where his life would not have gathered the same wide sensibility, the tormentor, if he pursued him, would be less formidable. To leave the place finally would, he knew, be extremely painful to his wife, and on other grounds he would have preferred to stay where he had struck root. Hence he made his preparations at first in a conditional way, wishing to leave on all sides an opening for his return after a brief absence, if any favourable intervention of Providence should dissipate his fears. He was preparing to transfer his management of the bank, and to give up any active control of other commercial affairs in the neighbourhood, on the ground of his failing health, but without excluding his future resumption of such work. The measure would cause him some added expense, and some diminution of income beyond what he had already undergone from the general depression of trade, and the hospital presented itself as a principal object of outlay on which he could fairly economize. This was the experience which had determined his conversation with Lydgate. But at this time his arrangements had, most of them, gone no farther than a stage at which he could recall them if they proved to be unnecessary. He continually deferred the final steps. In the midst of his fears, like many a man who is in danger of shipwreck or of being dashed from his carriage by runaway horses, he had a clinging impression that something would happen to hinder the worst, and that to spoil his life by a later transplantation might be over hasty, especially since it was difficult to account satisfactorily to his wife for the project of their indefinite exile from the only place where she would like to live. Among the affairs Bulstrode had to care for was the management of the farm at Stone Court in case of his absence, and on this, as well as on all other matters connected with any houses and land he possessed in or about Middlemarch, he had consulted Caleb Garth. Like everyone else who had business of that sort, he wanted to get the agent who was more anxious for his employer's interests than his own. With regard to Stone Court, since Bulstrode wished to retain his hold on the stock, and to have an arrangement by which he himself could, if he chose, resume his favourite recreation of superintendence, Caleb had advised him not to trust a mere bailiff, but to let the land, stock and implements yearly, and take a proportionate share of the proceeds.
"May I trust you to find me a tenant on these terms, Mr. Garth?" said Bulstrode. "And will you mention to me the yearly sum which would repay you for managing these affairs which we have discussed together?"
"I'll think about it," said Caleb in his blunt way. "I'll see how I can make it out." If it had not been that he had to consider Fred Vincey's future, Mr. Garth would not probably have been glad of any addition to his work, of which his wife was always fearing an excess for him as he grew older. But on quitting Bulstrode after that conversation, a very alluring idea occurred to him about this said letting of Stone Court. What if Bulstrode would agree to his placing Fred Vincey there, on the understanding that he, Caleb Garth, should be responsible for the management? It would be an excellent schooling for Fred. He might make a modest income there, and still have time left to get knowledge by helping in other business. He mentioned his notion to Mrs. Garth with such evident delight that she could not bear to chill his pleasure by expressing her constant fear of his undertaking too much. "The lad would be as happy as two," he said, throwing himself back in his chair and looking radiant. "If I could tell him it was all settled. Think, Susan, his mind had been running on that place for years before old Featherstone died, and it would be as pretty a turn of things as could be that he should hold the place in a good industrious way, after all, by his taking to business. For it's likely enough Bulstrode might let him go on and gradually buy the stock. He hasn't made up his mind, I can see, whether or not he shall settle somewhere else as a lasting thing. I never was better pleased with a notion in my life. And then the children might be married by and by, Susan.
You will not give any hint of the plan to Fred until you are sure that Bulstrode would agree to the plan, said Mrs. Garth, in a tone of gentle caution. And as to marriage, Caleb, we old people need not help to hasten it.
Oh, I don't know, said Caleb, swinging his head aside. Marriage is a taming thing. Fred would want less of my bit and bridle. However, I shall say nothing till I know the ground I'm treading on. I shall speak to Bulstrode again. He took his earliest opportunity of doing so. Bulstrode had anything but a warm interest in his nephew, Fred Vincey, but he had a strong wish to secure Mr. Garth's services on many scattered points of business at which he was sure to be a considerable loser if they were under less conscientious management. On that ground, he made no objection to Mr. Garth's proposal. And there was also another reason why he was not sorry to give a consent which was to benefit one of the Vincey family. It was that Mrs. Bulstrode, having heard of Lydgate's debts, had been anxious to know whether her husband could not do something for poor Rosamond, and had been much troubled on learning from him that Lydgate's affairs were not easily remediable, and that the wisest plan was to let them take their course. Mrs. Bulstrode had then said, for the first time,
I think you are always a little hard towards my family, Nicholas, and I am sure I have no reason to deny any of my relatives. Too worldly they may be, but no one ever had to say that they were not respectable. My dear Harriet, said Mr. Bulstrode, wincing under his wife's eyes, which were filling with tears, I have supplied your brother with a great deal of capital. I cannot be expected to take care of his married children.
That seemed to be true, and Mrs. Bulstrode's remonstrance subsided into pity for poor Rosamond, whose extravagant education she had always foreseen the fruits of. But remembering that dialogue, Mr. Bulstrode felt that when he had to talk to his wife fully about his plan of quitting Middlemarch, he should be glad to tell her that he had made an arrangement which might be for the good of her nephew Fred. At present, he had merely mentioned to her that he thought of shutting up the shrubs for a few months and taking a house on the southern coast. Hence Mr. Garth got the assurance he desired, namely, that in case of Bulstrode's departure from Middlemarch for an indefinite time, Fred Vincey should be allowed to have the tenancy of Stone Court on the terms proposed. Caleb was so elated with his hope of this neat turn being given to things that if his self-control had not been braced by a little affectionate wifely scolding, he would have betrayed everything to Mary, wanting to give the child comfort. However, he restrained himself and kept in strict privacy from Fred certain visits which he was making to Stone Court in order to look more thoroughly into the state of the land and stock and take a preliminary estimate. He was certainly more eager in these visits than the probable speed of events required him to be, but he was stimulated by a fatherly delight in occupying his mind with this bit of probable happiness, which he held in store like a hidden birthday gift for Fred and Mary.
"But suppose the whole scheme should turn out to be a castle in the air," said Mrs. Garth.
"Well, well," replied Caleb, "the castle will tumble about nobody's head."
Chapter 69. Mr. Bulstrode was still seated in his manager's room at the bank about 3 o'clock of the same day on which he had received Lydgate there, when the clerk entered to say that his horse was waiting, and also that Mr. Garth was outside and begged to speak with him.
"By all means," said Bulstrode, and Caleb entered. "Pray sit down, Mr. Garth," continued the banker, in his suavest tone. "I am glad that you arrived just in time to find me here. I know you count your minutes."
"Oh," said Caleb gently, with a slow swing of his head on one side as he seated himself and laid his hat on the floor. He looked at the ground, leaning forward and letting his long fingers droop between his legs, while each finger moved in succession, as if it was sharing some thought which filled his large, quiet brow. Mr. Bulstrode, like everyone else who knew Caleb, was used to his slowness in beginning to speak on any topic which he felt to be important, and rather expected that he was about to recur to the buying of some houses in Blind Man's Court for the sake of pulling them down, as a sacrifice of property which would be well repaid by the influx of air and light on that spot. It was by propositions of this kind that Caleb was sometimes troublesome to his employers, but he had usually found Bulstrode ready to meet him in projects of improvement, and they had got on well together. When he spoke again, however, it was to say in rather a subdued voice,
"I have just come away from Stone Court, Mr. Bulstrode."
"You found nothing wrong there, I hope," said the banker. "I was there myself yesterday. Abel has done well with the lambs this year."
"Why, yes," said Caleb, looking up gravely. "There is something wrong. A stranger who is very ill, I think. He wants a doctor, and I came to tell you of that. His name is Raffles."
He saw the shock of his words passing through Bulstrode's frame. On this subject the banker had thought that his fears were too constantly on the watch to be taken by surprise, but he had been mistaken.
"Poor wretch," he said in a compassionate tone, though his lips trembled a little. "Do you know how he came there?"
"I took him myself," said Caleb quietly. "Took him up in my gig. He had got down from the coach and was walking a little beyond the turning from the toll house, and I overtook him. He remembered seeing me with you once before at Stone Court, and he asked me to take him on. I saw he was ill. It seemed to me the right thing to do, to carry him under shelter. And now I think you should lose no time in getting advice for him."
Caleb took up his hat from the floor as he ended, and rose slowly from his seat.
"Certainly," said Bulstrode, whose mind was very active at this moment. "Perhaps you will yourself oblige me, Mr. Garth, by calling at Mr. Lydgate's as you pass. Or, stay. He may at this hour probably be at the hospital. I will first send my man on the horse there with a note this instant, and then I will myself ride to Stone Court."
Bulstrode quickly wrote a note, and went out himself to give the commission to his man. When he returned, Caleb was standing as before, with one hand on the back of the chair, holding his hat with the other. In Bulstrode's mind, the dominant thought was, perhaps Raffles only spoke to Garth of his illness. Garth may wonder, as he must have done before, at this disreputable fellow's claiming intimacy with me, but he will know nothing. And he is friendly to me. I can be of use to him. He longed for some information of this hopeful conjecture, but to have asked any question as to what Raffles had said or done would have been to betray fear.
"I am exceedingly obliged to you, Mr. Garth," he said in his usual tone of politeness. "My servant will be back in a few minutes, and I shall then go myself to see what can be done for this unfortunate man. Perhaps you had some other business with me? If so, pray be seated."
"Thank you," said Caleb, making a slight gesture with his right hand to waive the invitation. "I wish to say, Mr. Bulstrode, that I must request you to put your business into some other hands than mine. I am obliged to you for your handsome way of meeting me, about the letting of Stone Court and all other business. But I must give it up."
A sharp certainty entered like a stab into Bulstrode's soul.
"This is sudden, Mr. Garth,"
was all he could say at first.
"It is," said Caleb, "but it is quite fixed. I must give it up."
He spoke with a firmness which was very gentle, and yet he could see that Bulstrode seemed to cower under that gentleness, his face looking dried and his eyes swerving away from the glance which rested on him. Caleb felt a deep pity for him, but he could have used no pretexts to account for his resolve, even if they would have been of any use.
"You have been led to this, I apprehend, by some slanders concerning me, uttered by that unhappy creature," said Bulstrode,
anxious now to know the utmost.
"That is true. I can't deny that I act upon what I heard from him."
"You are a conscientious man, Mr. Garth, a man, I trust, who feels himself accountable to God. You would not wish to injure me by being too ready to believe a slander," said Bulstrode,
casting about for pleas that might be adapted to his hearer's mind.
That is a poor reason for giving up a connection which I think, I may say, will be mutually beneficial.
I would injure no man if I could help it, said Caleb, even if I thought God winked at it. I hope I should have a feeling for my fellow creature. But, sir, I am obliged to believe that this Raffles has told me the truth, and I can't be happy in working with you or profiting by you. It hurts my mind. I must beg you to seek another agent.
Very well, Mr. Garth. But I must at least claim to know the worst that he has told you. I must know what is the foul speech that I am liable to be the victim of, said Bulstrode, a certain amount of anger beginning to mingle with his humiliation before this quiet man who renounced his benefits.
That's needless, said Caleb, waving his hand, bowing his head slightly, and not swerving from the tone which had in it the merciful intention to spare this pitiable man. What he has said to me will never pass from my lips unless something now unknown forces it from me. If you led a harmful life for gain and kept others out of their rights by deceit to get them all for yourself, I dare say you repent. You would like to go back and can't. That must be a bitter thing.
Caleb paused a moment and shook his head. It is not for me to make your life harder to you.
But you do. You do make it harder to me, said Bulstrode,
constrained into a genuine pleading cry.
You make it harder to me by turning your back on me.
That I'm forced to do, said Caleb, still more gently, lifting up his hand. I am sorry. I don't judge you and say, he is wicked and I am righteous. God forbid. I don't know everything. A man may do wrong and his will may rise clear out of it, though he can't get his life clear. That's a bad punishment. If it is so with you, well, I'm very sorry for you. But I have that feeling inside me that I can't go on working with you. That's all, Mr. Bulstrode. Everything else is buried so far as my will goes. And I wish you good day.
One moment, Mr. Garth, said Bulstrode hurriedly. I may trust then to your solemn assurance that you will not repeat either to man or woman what, even if it had any degree of truth in it, is yet a malicious representation.
Caleb's wrath was stirred, and he said indignantly, Why should I have said it if I didn't mean it? I'm in no fear of you. Such tales as that will never tempt my tongue.
Excuse me. I am agitated. I am the victim of this abandoned man.
Stop a bit. You have got to consider whether you didn't help to make him worse when you profited by his vices.
You are wronging me by too readily believing him, said Bulstrode,
oppressed as by a nightmare, with the inability to deny flatly what Raffles might have said, and yet feeling it an escape that Caleb had not so stated it to him as to ask for that flat denial.
No, said Caleb, lifting his hand deprecatingly. I am ready to believe better when better is proved. I rob you of no good chance. As to speaking, I hold it a crime to expose a man's sin unless I am clear it must be done to save the innocent. That is my way of thinking, Mr. Bulstrode, and what I say I've no need to swear. I wish you good day.
Some hours later, when he was at home, Caleb said to his wife, incidentally, that he had had some little differences with Bulstrode, and that in consequence he had given up all notion of taking Stone Court, and had indeed resigned doing further business for him.
"He was disposed to interfere too much, was he?"
said Mrs. Garth, imagining that her husband had been touched on his sensitive point, and not been allowed to do what he thought right as to materials and modes of work.
"Oh," said Caleb, bowing his head and waving his hand gravely.
And Mrs. Garth knew that this was a sign of his not intending to speak further on the subject. As for Bulstrode, he had almost immediately mounted his horse and set off for Stone Court, being anxious to arrive there before Lydgate. His mind was crowded with images and conjectures which were a language to his hopes and fears, just as we hear tones from the vibrations which shake our whole system. The deep humiliation with which he had winced under Caleb Garth's knowledge of his past and rejection of his patronage alternated with and almost gave way to the sense of safety in the fact that Garth and no other had been the man to whom Raffles had spoken. It seemed to him a sort of earnest that Providence intended his rescue from worse consequences, the way being thus left open for the hope of secrecy. That Raffles should be afflicted with illness, that he should have been led to Stone Court rather than elsewhere. Bulstrode's heart fluttered at the vision of probabilities which these events conjured up. If it should turn out that he was freed from all danger of disgrace, if he could breathe in perfect liberty, his life should be more consecrated than it had ever been before. He mentally lifted up this vow, as if it would urge the result he longed for. He tried to believe in the potency of that prayerful resolution, its potency to determine death. He knew that he ought to say, "Thy will be done," and he said it often. But the intense desire remained that the will of God might be the death of that hated man. Yet when he arrived at Stone Court, he could not see the change in Raffles without a shock. But for his pallor and feebleness, Bulstrode would have called the change in him entirely mental. Instead of his loud, tormenting mood, he showed an intense, vague terror, and seemed to deprecate Bulstrode's anger because the money was all gone. He had been robbed, it had half of it been taken from him. He had only come here because he was ill and somebody was hunting him, somebody was after him. He had told nobody anything. He had kept his mouth shut. Bulstrode, not knowing the significance of these symptoms, interpreted this new nervous susceptibility into a means of alarming Raffles into true confessions, and taxed him with falsehood in saying that he had not told anything, since he had just told the man who took him up in his gig and brought him to Stone Court. Raffles denied this with solemn adjurations, the fact being that the links of consciousness were interrupted in him, and that his minute, terror-stricken narrative to Caleb Garth had been delivered under a set of visionary impulses which had dropped back into darkness. Bulstrode's heart sank again at this sign that he could get no grasp over the wretched man's mind, and that no word of Raffles could be trusted as to the fact which he most wanted to know, namely, whether or not he had really kept silence to everyone in the neighbourhood except Caleb Garth. The housekeeper had told him, without the least constraint of manner, that since Mr. Garth left, Raffles had asked her for beer, and after that had not spoken, seeming very ill. On that side it might be concluded that there had been no betrayal. Mrs. Abel thought, like the servants at the Shrubs, that the strange man belonged to the unpleasant kin who are among the troubles of the rich. She had at first referred the kinship to Mr. Rigg, and where there was property left, the buzzing presence of such large blue bottles seemed natural enough. How he could be kin to Bulstrode as well was not so clear, but Mrs. Abel agreed with her husband that there was no knowing, a proposition which had a great deal of mental food for her, so that she shook her head over it without further speculation. In less than an hour, Lydgate arrived. Bulstrode met him outside the wainscoted parlour where Raffles was, and said,
"I have called you in, Mr. Lydgate, to an unfortunate man who was once in my employment many years ago. Afterwards he went to America, and returned, I fear, to an idle, dissolute life. Being destitute, he has a claim on me. He was slightly connected with Rigg, the former owner of this place, and in consequence found his way here. I believe he is seriously ill. Apparently his mind is affected. I feel bound to do the utmost for him."
Lydgate, who had the remembrance of his last conversation with Bulstrode strongly upon him, was not disposed to say an unnecessary word to him, and bowed slightly in answer to this account. But just before entering the room, he turned automatically and said, "What is his name?" To know names, being as much a part of the medical man's accomplishment as of the practical politician's.
"Raffles. John Raffles," said Bulstrode,
who hoped that whatever became of Raffles, Lydgate would never know any more of him. When he had thoroughly examined and considered the patient, Lydgate ordered that he should go to bed and be kept there in as complete quiet as possible, and then went with Bulstrode into another room.
"It is a serious case, I apprehend,"
said the banker, before Lydgate began to speak. "No, and yes," said Lydgate, half dubiously. "It is difficult to decide as to the possible effect of long-standing complications.
but the man had a robust constitution to begin with. I should not expect this attack to be fatal, though of course the system is in a ticklish state. He should be well watched and attended to.
I will remain here myself, said Bulstrode. Mrs. Abel and her husband are inexperienced. I can easily remain here for the night, if you will oblige me by taking a note for Mrs. Bulstrode.
I should think that is hardly necessary, said Lydgate. He seems tame and terrified enough. He might become more unmanageable, but there is a man here, is there not?
I have more than once stayed here a few nights for the sake of seclusion, said Bulstrode indifferently. I am quite disposed to do so now. Mrs. Abel and her husband can relieve or aid me if necessary.
Very well, then I need give my directions only to you, said Lydgate, not feeling surprised at a little peculiarity in Bulstrode.
You think, then, that the case is hopeful?
Said Bulstrode, when Lydgate had ended giving his orders. Unless there turn out to be further complications, such as I have not at present detected, yes, said Lydgate. He may pass on to a worse stage, but I should not wonder if he got better in a few days by adhering to the treatment I have prescribed. There must be firmness. Remember, if he calls for liquors of any sort, not to give them to him. In my opinion, men in his condition are oftener killed by treatment than by the disease. Still, new symptoms may arise. I shall come again tomorrow morning. After waiting for the note to be carried to Mrs. Bulstrode, Lydgate rode away, forming no conjectures, in the first instance, about the history of Raffles, but rehearsing the whole argument which had lately been much stirred by the publication of Dr. Ware's abundant experience in America as to the right way of treating cases of alcoholic poisoning such as this. Lydgate, when abroad, had already been interested in this question. He was strongly convinced against the prevalent practice of allowing alcohol and persistently administering large doses of opium, and he had repeatedly acted on this conviction with a favourable result. The man is in a diseased state, he thought, but there's a good deal of wear in him still. I suppose he is an object of charity to Bulstrode. It is curious what patches of hardness and tenderness lie side by side in men's dispositions. Bulstrode seems the most unsympathetic fellow I ever saw about some people, and yet he has taken no end of trouble and spent a great deal of money on benevolent objects. I suppose he has some test by which he finds out whom heaven cares for. He has made up his mind that it doesn't care for me. This streak of bitterness came from a plenteous source, and kept widening in the current of his thought as he neared Lowick Gate. He had not been there since his first interview with Bulstrode in the morning, having been found at the hospital by the banker's messenger, and for the first time he was returning to his home without the vision of any expedient in the background, which left him a hope of raising money enough to deliver him from the coming destitution of everything which made his married life tolerable, everything which saved him and Rosamond from that bare isolation in which they would be forced to recognise how little of a comfort they could be to each other. It was more bearable to do without tenderness for himself than to see that his own tenderness could make no amends for the lack of other things to her. The sufferings of his own pride, from humiliations past and to come, were keen enough, yet they were hardly distinguishable to himself from that more acute pain which dominated them. The pain of foreseeing that Rosamond would come to regard him chiefly as the cause of disappointment and unhappiness to her. He had never liked the makeshifts of poverty, and they had never before entered into his prospects for himself. But he was beginning now to imagine how two creatures who loved each other and had a stock of thoughts in common might laugh over their shabby furniture and their calculations how far they could afford butter and eggs. But the glimpse of that poetry seemed as far off from him as the carelessness of the golden age. In poor Rosamond's mind, there was not room enough for luxuries to look small in. He got down from his horse in a very sad mood, and went into the house not expecting to be cheered except by his dinner, and reflecting that before the evening closed, it would be wise to tell Rosamond of his application to Bulstrode and his failure. It would be well not to lose time in preparing her for the worst. But his dinner waited long for him before he was able to eat it, for on entering he found that Dover's agent had already put a man in the house, and when he asked where Mrs. Lydgate was, he was told that she was in her bedroom. He went up and found her stretched on the bed, pale and silent, without an answer even in her face to any word or look of his. He sat down by the bed, and leaning over her said with almost a cry of prayer, "Forgive me for this misery, my poor Rosamond. Let us only love one another." She looked at him silently, still with the blank despair on her face. But the tears began to fill her blue eyes, and her lip trembled. The strong man had had too much to bear that day. He let his head fall beside hers and sobbed. He did not hinder her from going to her father early in the morning. It seemed now that he ought not to hinder her from doing as she pleased. In half an hour she came back, and said that Papa and Mama wished her to go and stay with them while things were in this miserable state. Papa said he could do nothing about the debt. If he paid this, there would be half a dozen more. She had better come back home again, till Lydgate had got a comfortable home for her. "Do you object, Tertius?"
"Do as you like," said Lydgate. "But things are not coming to a crisis immediately. There is no hurry."
"I should not go till tomorrow," said Rosamond. "I shall want to pack my clothes."
"Oh, I would wait a little longer than tomorrow. There is no knowing what may happen," said Lydgate, with bitter irony. "I may get my neck broken, and that may make things easier to you."
It was Lydgate's misfortune, and Rosamond's too, that his tenderness towards her, which was both an emotional prompting and a well-considered resolve, was inevitably interrupted by these outbursts of indignation, either ironical or remonstrant. She thought them totally unwarranted, and the repulsion which this exceptional severity excited in her was in danger of making the more persistent tenderness unacceptable.
"I see you do not wish me to go," she said with chill mildness. "Why can you not say so without that kind of violence? I shall stay until you request me to do otherwise."
Lydgate said no more, but went out on his rounds. He felt bruised and shattered, and there was a dark line under his eyes which Rosamond had not seen before. She could not bear to look at him. Tertius had a way of taking things which made them a great deal worse for her.
Chapter 70 Bulstrode's first object after Lydgate had left Stone Court was to examine Raffles' pockets, which he imagined were sure to carry signs in the shape of hotel bills of the places he had stopped in, if he had not told the truth in saying that he had come straight from Liverpool because he was ill and had no money. There were various bills crammed into his pocketbook, but none of a later date than Christmas at any other place, except one which bore date that morning. This was crumpled up with a handbill about a horse fair in one of his tail pockets, and represented the cost of 3 days' stay at an inn at Bilkley, where the fair was held, a town at least 40 miles from Middlemarch. The bill was heavy, and since Raffles had no luggage with him, it seemed probable that he had left his portmanteau behind in payment, in order to save money for his travelling fare, for his purse was empty, and he had only a couple of sixpences and some loose pence in his pockets. Bulstrode gathered a sense of safety from these indications that Raffles had really kept at a distance from Middlemarch since his memorable visit at Christmas. At a distance, and among people who were strangers to Bulstrode, what satisfaction could there be to Raffles' tormenting, self-magnifying vein in telling old scandalous stories about a Middlemarch banker? And what harm if he did talk? The chief point now was to keep watch over him, as long as there was any danger of that intelligible raving, that unaccountable impulse to tell, which seemed to have acted towards Caleb Garth. And Bulstrode felt much anxiety lest some such impulse should come over him at the sight of Lydgate. He sat up alone with him through the night, only ordering the housekeeper to lie down in her clothes so as to be ready when he called her, alleging his own indisposition to sleep and his anxiety to carry out the doctor's orders. He did carry them out faithfully. Although Raffles was incessantly asking for brandy and declaring that he was sinking away, that the earth was sinking away from under him. He was restless and sleepless, but still quailing and manageable. On the offer of the food ordered by Lydgate, which he refused, and the denial of other things which he demanded, He seemed to concentrate all his terror on Bulstrode, imploringly deprecating his anger, his revenge on him by starvation, and declaring with strong oaths that he had never told any mortal a word against him. Even this Bulstrode felt that he would not have liked Lydgate to hear. But a more alarming sign of fitful alternation in his delirium was that in the morning twilight, Raffles suddenly seemed to imagine a doctor present, addressing him and declaring that Bulstrode wanted to starve him to death out of revenge for telling, when he never had told. Bulstrode's native imperiousness and strength of determination served him well. This delicate-looking man, himself nervously perturbed, found the needed stimulus in his strenuous circumstances, and through that difficult night and morning, while he had the air of an animated corpse returned to movement without warmth, holding the mastery by its chill impassibility, his mind was intensely at work, thinking of what he had to guard against and what would win him security. Whatever prayers he might lift up, whatever statements he might inwardly make of this man's wretched spiritual condition, and the duty he himself was under to submit to the punishment divinely appointed for him rather than to wish for evil to another, through all this effort to condense words into a solid mental state, there pierced and spread with irresistible vividness the images of the events he desired. And in the train of those images came their apology. He could not but see the death of Raffles, and see in it his own deliverance. What was the removal of this wretched creature? He was impenitent, but were not public criminals impenitent, yet the law decided on their fate? Should Providence in this case award death, there was no sin in contemplating death as the desirable issue. If he kept his hands from hastening it, if he scrupulously did what was prescribed. Even here there might be a mistake. Human prescriptions were fallible things. Lydgate had said that treatment had hastened death. Why not his own method of treatment? But, of course, intention was everything in the question of right and wrong. And Bulstrode set himself to keep his intention separate from his desire. He inwardly declared that he intended to obey orders. Why should he have got into any argument about the validity of these orders? It was only the common trick of desire, which avails itself of any irrelevant scepticism, finding larger room for itself in all uncertainty about effects, in every obscurity that looks like the absence of law. Still, he did obey the orders. His anxieties continually glanced towards Lydgate, and his remembrance of what had taken place between them the morning before was accompanied with sensibilities which had not been roused at all during the actual scene. He had then cared but little about Lydgate's painful impressions with regard to the suggested change in the hospital, or about the disposition towards himself, which what he held to be his justifiable refusal of a rather exorbitant request might call forth. He recurred to the scene now, with a perception that he had probably made Lydgate his enemy, and with an awakened desire to propitiate him, or rather to create in him a strong sense of personal obligation. He regretted that he had not at once made even an unreasonable money sacrifice, for in case of unpleasant suspicions or even knowledge gathered from the raving of Raffles, Bulstrode would have felt that he had a defence in Lydgate's mind by having conferred a momentous benefit on him. But the regret had perhaps come too late. Strange, piteous conflict in the soul of this unhappy man, who had longed for years to be better than he was, who had taken his selfish passions into discipline and clad them in severe robes so that he had walked with them as a devout choir, till now, that a terror had risen among them and they could chant no longer, but threw out their common cries for safety. It was nearly the middle of the day before Lydgate arrived. He had meant to come earlier but had been detained, he said, and his shattered looks were noticed by Bulstrode. But he immediately threw himself into the consideration of the patient, and inquired strictly into all that had occurred. Raffles was worse, would take hardly any food, was persistently wakeful and restlessly raving, but still not violent. Contrary to Bulstrode's alarmed expectation, he took little notice of Lydgate's presence and continued to talk or murmur incoherently.
"What do you think of him?"
said Bulstrode in private. "The symptoms are worse."
"You are less hopeful?"
"No,
I still think he may come round. Are you going to stay here yourself? Said Lydgate, looking at Bulstrode with an abrupt question which made him uneasy, though in reality it was not due to any suspicious conjecture.
Yes, I think so,
said Bulstrode, governing himself and speaking with deliberation.
Mrs. Bulstrode is advised of the reasons which detain me. Mrs. Abel and her husband are not experienced enough to be left quite alone, and this kind of responsibility is scarcely included in their service of me. You have some fresh instructions, I presume.
The chief new instruction that Lydgate had to give was on the administration of extremely moderate doses of opium in case of the sleeplessness continuing after several hours. He had taken the precaution of bringing opium in his pocket, and he gave minute directions to Bulstrode as to the doses and the point at which they should cease. He insisted on the risk of not ceasing, and repeated his order that no alcohol should be given. "From what I see of the case," he ended, "narcotism is the only thing I should be much afraid of. He may wear through even without much food. There's a good deal of strength in him."
"You look ill yourself, Mr. Lydgate. A most unusual, I may say, unprecedented thing in my knowledge of you," said Bulstrode, showing a solicitude as unlike his indifference the day before as his present recklessness about his own fatigue was unlike his habitual self-cherishing anxiety. "I fear you are harassed."
"Yes, I am," said Lydgate brusquely, holding his hat and ready to go.
"Something new, I fear," said Bulstrode inquiringly. "Pray be seated."
"No, thank you," said Lydgate with some hauteur. "I mentioned to you yesterday what was the state of my affairs. There is nothing to add, except that the execution has since then been actually put into my house. One can tell a good deal of trouble in a short sentence. I will say good morning."
"Stay, Mr. Lydgate, stay," said Bulstrode. "I have been reconsidering this subject. I was yesterday taken by surprise and saw it superficially. Mrs. Bulstrode is anxious for her niece, and I myself should grieve at a calamitous change in your position. Claims on me are numerous, but on reconsideration, I esteem it right that I should incur a small sacrifice rather than leave you unaided. You said, I think, that £1,000 would suffice entirely to free you from your burthens and enable you to recover a firm stand."
"Yes," said Lydgate, a great leap of joy within him surmounting every other feeling. "That would pay all my debts and leave me a little on hand. I could set about economizing in our way of living, and by my practice might look up."
"If you will wait a moment, Mr. Lydgate, I will draw a check to that amount. I am aware that help to be effectual in these cases should be thorough."
While Bulstrode wrote, Lydgate turned to the window thinking of his home, thinking of his life with its good start saved from frustration, its good purposes still unbroken.
"You can give me a note of hand for this, Mr. Lydgate," said the banker, advancing towards him with the check. "And by, I hope, you may be in circumstances gradually to repay me. Meanwhile, I have great pleasure in thinking that you will be released from further difficulty."
"I am deeply obliged to you," said Lydgate. "You have restored to me the prospect of working with some happiness and some chance of good." It appeared to him a very natural movement in Bulstrode that he should have reconsidered his refusal. It corresponded with the more munificent side of his character. But as he put his hack into a canter that he might get the sooner home and tell the good news to Rosamond and get cash at the bank to pay over to Dover's agent, there crossed his mind, with an unpleasant impression, as from a dark-winged flight of evil augury across his vision, the thought of that contrast in himself which a few months had brought, that he should be overjoyed at being under a strong personal obligation, that he should be overjoyed at getting money for himself from Bulstrode. The banker felt that he had done something to nullify one cause of uneasiness, and yet he was scarcely the easier. He did not measure the quantity of diseased motive which had made him wish for Lydgate's goodwill.
but the quantity was nonetheless actively there, like an irritating agent in his blood. A man vows, and yet will not cast away the means of breaking his vow. Is it that he distinctly means to break it? Not at all. But the desires which tend to break it are at work in him dimly, and make their way into his imagination, and relax his muscles in the very moments when he is telling himself over again the reasons for his vow. Raffles recovering quickly, returning to the free use of his odious powers. How could Bulstrode wish for that? Raffles dead was the image that brought release, and indirectly he prayed for that way of release, beseeching that if it were possible, the rest of his days here below might be freed from the threat of an ignominy which would break him utterly as an instrument of God's service. Lydgate's opinion was not on the side of promise that this prayer would be fulfilled, and as the day advanced, Bulstrode felt himself getting irritated at the persistent life in this man whom he would fain have seen sinking into the silence of death. Imperious will stirred murderous impulses towards this brute life over which will by itself had no power. He said inwardly that he was getting too much worn. He would not sit up with the patient tonight, but leave him to Mrs. Abel, who, if necessary, could call her husband. At 6 o'clock, Raffles, having had only fitful, perturbed snatches of sleep, from which he waked with fresh restlessness and perpetual cries that he was sinking away, Bulstrode began to administer the opium according to Lydgate's directions. At the end of half an hour or more, he called Mrs. Abel and told her that he found himself unfit for further watching. He must now consign the patient to her care, and he proceeded to repeat to her Lydgate's directions as to the quantity of each dose. Mrs. Abel had not before known anything of Lydgate's prescriptions. She had simply prepared and brought whatever Bulstrode ordered, and had done what he pointed out to her. She began now to ask what else she should do besides administering the opium.
"Nothing at present except the offer of the soup or the soda water. You can come to me for further directions. Unless there is any important change, I shall not come into the room again tonight. You will ask your husband for help if necessary. I must go to bed early."
"You've much need, sir, I'm sure," said Mrs. Abel, "and to take something more strengthening than what you've done."
Bulstrode went away now without anxiety as to what Raffles might say in his raving, which had taken on a muttering incoherence not likely to create any dangerous belief. At any rate, he must risk this. He went down into the wainscoted parlour first, and began to consider whether he would not have his horse saddle and go home by the moonlight and give up caring for earthly consequences. Then he wished that he had begged Lydgate to come again that evening. Perhaps he might deliver a different opinion and think that Raffles was getting into a less hopeful state. Should he send for Lydgate? If Raffles were really getting worse and slowly dying, Bulstrode felt that he could go to bed and sleep in gratitude to Providence. But was he worse? Lydgate might come and simply say that he was going on as he expected, and predict that he would by and by fall into a good sleep and get well. What was the use of sending for him? Bulstrode shrank from that result. No ideas or opinions could hinder him from seeing the one probability to be that Raffles recovered would be just the same man as before, with his strength as a tormentor renewed, obliging him to drag away his wife to spend her years apart from her friends and native place, carrying an alienating suspicion against him in her heart. He had sat an hour and a half in this conflict by the firelight only, when a sudden thought made him rise and light the bed-candle which he had brought down with him. The thought was that he had not told Mrs. Abel when the doses of opium must cease. He took hold of the candlestick but stood motionless for a long while. She might already have given him more than Lydgate had prescribed, but it was excusable in him that he should forget part of an order in his present wearied condition. He walked upstairs, candle in hand, not knowing whether he should straightway enter his own room and go to bed, or turn to the patient's room and rectify his omission. He paused in the passage, with his face turned towards Raffles' room, and he could hear him moaning and murmuring. He was not asleep then. Who could know that Lydgate's prescription would not be better disobeyed than followed, since there was still no sleep? He turned into his own room. Before he had quite undressed, Mrs. Abel rapped at the door. He opened it an inch so that he could hear her speak low.
"If you please, sir, should I have no brandy nor nothing to give the poor creature? He feels sinking away, and nothing else will he swallow, and but little strength in it if he did, only the opium. And he says more and more he's sinking down through the earth."
To her surprise, Mr. Bulstrode did not answer. A struggle was going on within him.
"I think he must die for want of support if he goes on in that way. When I nursed my poor master, Mr. Robison, I had to give him port wine and brandy constant, and a big glass at a time," added Mrs. Abel, with a touch of remonstrance in her tone.
But again Mr. Bulstrode did not answer immediately, and she continued,
"It's not a time to spare when people are at death's door, nor would you wish it, sir, I'm sure. Else I should give him our own bottle of rum as we keep by us. But a sitter-up so as you've been, and doing everything as lied in your power."
Here a key was thrust through the inch of doorway, and Mr. Bulstrode said huskily,
"That is the key of the wine cooler. You will find plenty of brandy there."
Early in the morning, about 6, Mr. Bulstrode rose and spent some time in prayer. Does anyone suppose that private prayer is necessarily candid, necessarily goes to the roots of action? Private prayer is inaudible speech, and speech is representative. Who can represent himself just as he is, even in his own reflections? Bulstrode had not yet unravelled in his thought the confused promptings of the last 24 hours. He listened in the passage, and could hear hard, stertorous breathing. Then he walked out in the garden and looked at the early rime on the grass and fresh spring leaves. When he re-entered the house, he felt startled at the sight of Mrs. Abel.
"How is your patient? Asleep, I think," he said, with an attempt at cheerfulness in his tone.
"He's gone very deep, sir," said Mrs. Abel. "He went off gradual between 3 and 4 o'clock. Would you please to go and look at him? I thought it no harm to leave him. My man's gone afield, and the little girl's seeing to the kettles."
Bulstrode went up. At a glance, he knew that Raffles was not in the sleep which brings revival, but in the sleep which streams deeper and deeper into the gulf of death. He looked round the room and saw a bottle with some brandy in it and the almost empty opium phial. He put the phial out of sight and carried the brandy bottle downstairs with him, locking it again in the wine cooler. While breakfasting, he considered whether he should ride to Middlemarch at once or wait for Lydgate's arrival. He decided to wait, and told Mrs. Abel that she might go about her work. He could watch in the bedchamber. As he sat there and beheld the enemy of his peace going irrevocably into silence, he felt more at rest than he had done for many months. His conscience was soothed by the enfolding wing of secrecy, which seemed just then like an angel sent down for his relief. He drew out his pocketbook to review various memoranda there as to the arrangements he had projected and partly carried out in the prospect of quitting Middlemarch, and considered how far he would let them stand or recall them, now that his absence would be brief. Some economies which he felt desirable might still find a suitable occasion in his temporary withdrawal from management, and he hoped still that Mrs. Casaubon would take a large share in the expenses of the hospital. In that way the moments passed, until a change in the stertorous breathing was marked enough to draw his attention wholly to the bed, and forced him to think of the departing life which had once been subservient to his own, which he had once been glad to find base enough for him to act as he would. It was his gladness then which impelled him now to be glad that the life was at an end. And who could say that the death of Raffles had been hastened? Who knew what would have saved him? Lydgate arrived at 10:30, in time to witness the final pause of the breath. When he entered the room, Bulstrode observed a sudden expression in his face, which was not so much surprise
as a recognition that he had not judged correctly. He stood by the bed in silence for some time, with his eyes turned on the dying man, but with that subdued activity of expression which showed that he was carrying on an inward debate. "When did this change begin?" said he, looking at Bulstrode.
"I did not watch by him last night," said Bulstrode. "I was overworn and left him under Mrs. Abel's care. She said that he sank into sleep between 3 and 4 o'clock. When I came in before 8, he was nearly in this condition."
Lydgate did not ask another question, but watched in silence until he said, "It's all over." This morning, Lydgate was in a state of recovered hope and freedom. He had set out on his work with all his old animation, and felt strong enough to bear all the deficiencies of his married life. And he was conscious that Bulstrode had been a benefactor to him. But he was uneasy about this case. He had not expected it to terminate as it had done. Yet he hardly knew how to put a question on the subject to Bulstrode without appearing to insult him. And if he examined the housekeeper, why, the man was dead. There seemed to be no use in implying that somebody's ignorance or imprudence had killed him. And after all, he himself might be wrong. He and Bulstrode rode back to Middlemarch together, talking of many things, chiefly cholera and the chances of the Reform Bill in the House of Lords, and the firm resolve of the political unions. Nothing was said about Raffles, except that Bulstrode mentioned the necessity of having a grave for him in Lowick Churchyard, and observed that, so far as he knew, the poor man had no connections except Rigg, whom he had stated to be unfriendly towards him. On returning home, Lydgate had a visit from Mr. Fairbrother. The vicar had not been in town the day before, but the news that there was an execution in Lydgate's house had got to Lowick by the evening, having been carried by Mr. Spicer, shoemaker and parish clerk, who had it from his brother, the respectable bell-hanger in Lowick Gate. Since that evening when Lydgate had come down from the billiard-room with Fred Vincey, Mr. Fairbrother's thoughts about him had been rather gloomy. Playing at the Green Dragon once or oftener might have been a trifle in another man, but in Lydgate it was one of several signs that he was getting unlike his former self. He was beginning to do things for which he had formerly even an excessive scorn. Whatever certain dissatisfactions in marriage, which some silly tinklings of gossip had given him hints of, might have to do with this change, Mr. Fairbrother felt that it was chiefly connected with the debts which were being more and more distinctly reported, and he began to fear that any notion of Lydgate's having resources or friends in the background must be quite illusory. The rebuff he had met with in his first attempt to win Lydgate's confidence disinclined him to a second, but this news of the execution being actually in the house determined the vicar to overcome his reluctance. Lydgate had just dismissed a poor patient in whom he was much interested, and he came forward to put out his hand with an open cheerfulness which surprised Mr. Fairbrother. Could this, too, be a proud rejection of sympathy and help? Never mind. The sympathy and help should be offered. "How are you, Lydgate? I came to see you because I had heard something which made me anxious about you," said the vicar, in the tone of a good brother, only that there was no reproach in it. They were both seated by this time, and Lydgate answered immediately, "I think I know what you mean. You had heard that there was an execution in the house?"
"Yes. Is it true?"
"It was true," said Lydgate, with an air of freedom, as if he did not mind talking about the affair now. "But the danger is over. The debt is paid. I am out of my difficulties now. I shall be freed from debts and able, I hope, to start afresh on a better plan."
"I am very thankful to hear it," said the vicar, falling back in his chair, and speaking with that low-toned quickness which often follows the removal of a load. "I like that better than all the news in the Times. I confess I came to you with a heavy heart."
"Thank you for coming," said Lydgate cordially. "I can enjoy the kindness all the more because I am happier. I have certainly been a good deal crushed. I'm afraid I shall find the bruises still painful by and by," he added, smiling rather sadly. "But just now I can only feel that the torture screw is off." Mr. Fairbrother was silent for a moment, and then said earnestly, "My dear fellow, let me ask you one question.
forgive me if I take a liberty. I don't believe you will ask anything that ought to offend me.
Then, this is necessary to set my heart quite at rest. You have not, have you, in order to pay your debts, incurred another debt which may harass you worse hereafter?
No, said Lydgate, colouring slightly. There is no reason why I should not tell you, since the fact is so, that the person to whom I am indebted is Bulstrode. He has made me a very handsome advance, £1,000, and he can afford to wait for repayment.
Well, that is generous, said Mr. Fairbrother, compelling himself to approve of the man whom he disliked.
His delicate feeling shrank from dwelling even in his thought on the fact that he had always urged Lydgate to avoid any personal entanglement with Bulstrode. He added immediately, "And Bulstrode must naturally feel an interest in your welfare, after you have worked with him in a way which has probably reduced your income instead of adding to it. I am glad to think that he has acted accordingly."
Lydgate felt uncomfortable under these kindly suppositions. They made more distinct within him the uneasy consciousness which had shown its first dim stirrings only a few hours before. That Bulstrode's motives for his sudden beneficence following close upon the chillest indifference might be merely selfish. He let the kindly suppositions pass. He could not tell the history of the loan, but it was more vividly present with him than ever, as well as the fact which the vicar delicately ignored, that this relation of personal indebtedness to Bulstrode was what he had once been most resolved to avoid. He began, instead of answering, to speak of his projected economies, and of his having come to look at his life from a different point of view.
"I shall set up a surgery," he said. "I really think I made a mistaken effort in that respect. And if Rosamond will not mind, I shall take an apprentice. I don't like these things, but if one carries them out faithfully, they are not really lowering. I have had a severe galling to begin with. That will make the small rubs seem easy."
Poor Lydgate. The "if Rosamond will not mind," which had fallen from him involuntarily as part of his thought, was a significant mark of the yoke he bore. But Mr. Fairbrother, whose hopes entered strongly into the same current with Lydgate's, and who knew nothing about him that could now raise a melancholy presentiment, left him with affectionate congratulation.
End of disc 22.